Welcome to another episode of COVID Chronicles, a podcast by, for, and about people affiliated with Portland Mennonite Church in Portland, Oregon. I'm your host, Gloria Nussbaum, and my guest is Stephen Obold Eshelman. Welcome, Stephen. It's great to have you with me.
Thank you, Gloria.
What we do these days is we start at the beginning, and I'm pretty sure that you are not a native Oregonian. Tell me a bit about your origin story. Where did life start for you?
Right. Well, it started way back in 1973 in Lansdale, Pennsylvania. That's where my parents were living. My parents are Ruth and Fred Obold. They currently attend Portland Mennonite Church. And that's where I was born and lived there for a little while until my dad went to seminary in Indiana. And then our family moved back to Pennsylvania for a little bit. And I mostly grew up in Kansas, where my dad was a pastor, and was in Kansas all through high school and college. And then after college, to Dallas, Texas for Mennonite voluntary service. And then after that, I decided to go to seminary. And then after seminary in 2004, well, I met Krista Eshelman. And goodness, she's from Oregon. And so, you know, we're weighing the difference between Kansas and Oregon. And well, here I am. That's a quick version.
So we're going to go back and pick up some details. How many children are in your family and where do you fit?
I joined an older sister. She currently lives in the Kansas City area. And so there are my folks and my sister, Rebecca. And she is a special education teacher. She has a husband and a daughter who's a junior in high school.
And your name is Stephen, and it's spelled a certain way. Do you know anything about the story behind your name and why your parents named you this?
Oh, goodness. Yeah, I've asked my parents that story. And my mother, oh, goodness, she'll have to correct me when she listens to this. They talked about many different names. I could have been a Jonathan, but I already had a cousin named Jonathan. I think I could have been a David. And then I'm glad I'm Stephen. And it's spelled with a PH in the middle. And that's very important. I'm not a Stephen or a Steve, but a Stephen. Of course, biblically, Stephen was the first martyr, but also means, I believe, crowned one or something like that in Hebrew. So that's how I have come to identify myself and embrace that.
And just for the record, what's your middle name?
Frederick, as in my father's name, Frederick Obold.
So it sounds like you mostly grew up in Kansas.
Yeah.
Tell me something special about growing up in Kansas, because I think sometimes Oregonians are a little snooty about living in Oregon. So maybe you could help us out here just a little.
Well, anecdotally, you know, Kansas has as many colors of orange and yellow and pinks and reds as Oregon has hues of green. And so when I moved to Oregon, I didn't really know that there were so many different colors of green here. And like Kansas, those sunsets, those sunrises are indelibly marked in my memory of growing up there.
Specifically, where in Kansas were you living?
We were living 3.5 miles south and 5 miles east of Inman, Kansas, out in the country, 1/2 mile from the McPherson or the Harvey County line. This is a very rural congregation of Mennonites called Hufningsau, and they were part of the Mennonites that came from Russia, from the Ukraine. And so I grew up eating the ethnic Mennonite foods of Veronica, of New Year's cookies, and also very aware of the different stripes of Mennonites in that area. Our church was very general conference from Ukraine, but across the river, and what I mean by river is a small stream called the Turkey Creek. And over on that side lived the Mennonites who came from Switzerland. And there the two shall meet. Oh, we were the biggest rivals in sports teams. Edmond against Mound Ridge. You talk about like the Timbers and the Seattle Sounders soccer rivalry. This was even bigger than that. So there's competition very much so in some parts of the Kansas Mennonite world.
And that other congregation, was that at that time known as Mennonite Church, or was that still Old Mennonite?
It used to be General Conference Mennonite, and it was Western District Conference. So it was very much through and through a General Conference Mennonite Church. It was not yet Mennonite USA. It was not Old Mennonite. It was General Conference Mennonite.
That's your church that you went to?
Correct.
And that other congregation, the one on the other side of the stream?
Some were General Conference, but others would have been Mennonite Conference. Yeah.
As you were growing up, did you know what was different about your two congregations?
On the surface level, I understood that the other, and we talk about us and them, I and the other, I became aware at a very early age of divisions that even happen with our brothers and sisters within the Mennonite Church. And from some reason, I understood that the other, which was not my home church, did things differently, mainly in church structure and how they made decisions. But really, I didn't have that good of an understanding back then. Theologically, I don't know if I can really speak to those differences, but socially and the ethnic identities were very strong. And in terms of food that different groups ate and how they identified themselves with very insular communities.
So when you went away to college, where was that?
I went to Bethel College in North Newton, Kansas, which is a Mennonite college. And well, back then, or soon about there, it would have been associated with the General Conference. So that was our church's college. That was our college that many, not all, but many of my cohort from that area went to. And that's where I went.
What did you major in, and when and how did you make that decision?
I majored in history and social sciences. I graduated in 1996. I started out as an education major. Both of my parents had been teachers at one time or another in their lives. My sister is an education major, so, well, there we go. And early in my sophomore year, I realized, no, this isn't for me. So I spent some time kind of wandering around, and I found that I really liked social sciences, and particularly history. I had a great history professors at Bethel College, Keith Sprunger and Jim Yonke, and they had a way of really engaging the student from an historical perspective, but yes, a very Mennonite Anabaptist perspective of history. And that's something that was meaningful to me, to help reinforce those early identities and burgeoning identities of growing into a Mennonite way of being.
At that time, did you know what you planned to do with that major?
Not a clue, Gloria. I realized later on in life that I tended to major in things that were very interesting to me, but were not very marketable in terms of getting a job. Now, in retrospect, what I was learning, and I can talk about this later, but at Bethel College, one of the biggest things I'm appreciative of, grateful for, is instilling a critical way of thinking. Some might call it deconstructing. Some might call it, well, it's part of the beauty of a liberal arts education, and especially from a Mennonite institution of higher learning, is critical thinking skills and seeing a world from a different perspective. And the faculty and staff there, along with their religion department, really opened up a lot of good questions for me.
So what happened after you graduated? Sounds like you maybe did a year of service or so?
Oh, yes. After I graduated from Bethel, I moved to Dallas, Texas with Mennonite Voluntary Service. I worked at a nonprofit legal agency called Proyecto Adelante, which means Project Onward or Forward. And I helped primarily people from El Salvador and Guatemala apply for political asylum here in the United States. These were refugees from the civil wars in Central America during the 1980s. And I went there for a couple of reasons. One, I wanted to use the Spanish that I had learned in college. That was a minor, as well as to expose myself to a world in the megaplex of Dallas, Texas, that was vastly different than the communities that I grew up in South Central Kansas. Communities of vast diversity, both demographically, but also politically as well. So I spent, well, I originally signed up for 2 years of Mennonite Voluntary Service. That got extended to a third. And then I worked for an immigration attorney in private practice, doing the same things, helping people apply for political asylum. And during that time, I had these incessant theological questions that kept going through my mind. And so I began thinking about seminaries in a more serious way, not in terms of becoming a pastor, but these questions were so persistent and so bothersome in a good way that in a sense they propelled me toward not finding answers, but somehow searching for responses. And so I decided to go to what was then Associated Mennonite Biblical Seminary, or now known as Anabaptist Mennonite Biblical Seminary, for help in addressing these questions. And so for 3 years in Northern Indiana, I studied, and Krista, my wife, was at law school at Notre Dame University at the very same time. So we would come home and would have fabulous discussions about religion and law during both of our graduate experiences.
But we have to know how someone from AMBS and someone from Notre Dame actually met each other. Granted, they're not that far apart geographically, but...
Oh, that's a great question, Gloria. So, Krista was also in Mennonite Voluntary Service, and she was in San Francisco, and she called up our unit in Dallas one day and said, I'm thinking about coming to Dallas because I want to work with refugees and I want to use my Spanish. And, well, there was this guy there who worked at this agency called Proyecto Adelante. And, of course, he spoke with her over the phone and told her about the agency. And ultimately, she decided to move into the volunteer unit house. Well, goodness, there are these two 20-something Mennonites living in a Mennonite volunteer house. She had gone to Eastern Mennonite University. I had gone to Bethel. And, you know, they started living together. And then they started dating, which is kind of funny in the Mennonite world. But we were, yes, we were living together with other Mennonite volunteers in this unit house and both working at the same nonprofit immigration agency. And, well, there you have it.
So I assume that you made the decision maybe to go to Northern Indiana because you would both be there. Did that play a role in how you ended up where you ended up?
It did. Ultimately, I wanted to go to AMBS, which meant that that pretty drastically limited Krista's options for law school. So she looked in the Chicago area and ultimately decided on Notre Dame and was accepted and got financial assistance for them as well. So that's how she ended up at Notre Dame, Domer, and I ended up at AMBS.
and you would have amazing conversations when you got together.
Indeed, we would.
I would love to ask you what some of those theological questions were that you had, but I don't want to take the time right now, but we may have to have a private conversation some other time. I'm so curious. At what point did this relationship become a little more permanent?
We decided to marry a few weeks into our first year of graduate studies, so very early on. And then we were married later that summer in 2002 at Krista's parents' home, Leon and Diana Eshelman. And at that time, they were living in West Salem, Oregon.
Was that your first time to Oregon? Or probably you'd been there to visit her family previous to that?
I had been to her to Oregon to visit her family. In fact, Gloria, this might be jumping ahead a little bit, but my first experience at Portland Mennonite Church was in the summer of 1989, when I was a freshman in high school. I participated in what was known as Mennonite Youth Venture, and there was a service opportunity, and it was located at what was then Peace Mennonite Church out in Gresham. And so in 1989, I spent 3 weeks living out there, experiencing Oregon, and my first encounter with PMC was a softball game arranged through our unit leaders of Peace Mennonite against Portland Mennonite. And for the record, Peace Mennonite, with the help of Mennonite Youth Venture teenagers, beat Portland Mennonite probably by the score of 62-20. That was a great fun. I would have loved to see or to know who against these now members I may have played against as a teenager.
That's a great story. So jumping ahead or jumping back, so you got married, spent 3 years in Indiana?
Yes, we did, from 2001 to 2004.
What degree did you end up with from there?
Master of Divinity in a theological studies concentration.
Again, something that you can easily find a job with.
You know, I thought when I'd graduate from AMBS, I spent a lot of intellectual energy, emotional energy, in restorative justice work. In Elkhart, Indiana, I worked at what was called the Center for Community Justice, doing victim-offender reconciliation work, which was called the VORT program back then. And so upon moving out to Oregon in 2004, I thought that I would continue doing restorative justice work. Oregon being a very progressive state, known for many things, I thought it would be easy to get up doing restorative justice work out here. And so when we moved, I wrote letters. Yes, we used to write letters back then. Contacted various agencies, and they all responded saying, "Oh, yes, we'd love to have you come work for us. Sorry, we can't pay you." So, being out of graduate school, needed a job that would pay something. So I found an opportunity working for Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon in their refugee resettlement office. And that was a sort of a continuation of what I had previously done. Although here in Oregon, it was more of a social work focus rather than a legal focus. And that's where I worked for 14 years until becoming a chaplain.
And did you have to go back and get some more schooling to become a chaplain, or what form did that take?
Yes, I had considered chaplaincy for quite some time. And the story I kind of like to tell is one Saturday at the Advent workshop at Portland Mennonite in the basement, our own Bree Krueger came up to me, and she was doing a chaplaincy residency program at the Veterans Affairs Hospital here in Portland. And she tapped me on the shoulder and she said, "Stephen, you know, they're looking for chaplains at the VA." And that was all the bugging that needed to happen. That was a Saturday. On Monday, I contacted the people in charge at the VA, submitted my application, and by January, I was working as an intern at the VA as a chaplain. Later on that spring, I was accepted into their formal residency program called CPE, which is Clinical Pastoral Education, and that's the formal training program that chaplains undergo. Did that for a year, and that program ended last year about this time, and now I am currently working at Legacy Salmon Creek Medical Center in Vancouver, Washington, as a full-time staff chaplain.
Again, jumping ahead, we're in the midst of a pandemic, and you're a chaplain in a hospital. Tell us just a little bit about what that's like for you now in the midst, and I'm assuming you're doing this in person.
Correct. It's in person. Nothing is, I drive to the hospital every day. That's a terrific question. It is deeply enriching. It's beautifully difficult work. It's beautifully difficult work under ordinary circumstances. And it's even more so now with the pandemic. There is high acuity, meaning very intense medical cases. There's also high mortality, which is very sad. There are callbacks in the middle of the night that happen on a frequent basis to provide support for families, for patients. What I appreciate so much about chaplaincy is companioning people, is being present during very vulnerable times, often the worst times of their lives. There are many sad endings, but also very happy endings as well. People who do get better, and that's part of the perspective as well, as to celebrate and to dwell in all of that mix. The patients that I experience or have encounters with during this pandemic express feelings of significant isolation and loneliness because of the limited visitors allowed in the hospital. It is daunting enough to go to a hospital under the best scenarios, but because hardly any visitors are allowed in to provide that family support, it makes things extra difficult. And what I think often we underestimate or overlook is that, you know, in a medical healthcare setting, there is so much emphasis put on the science aspect. So many measurables, so many tangible things. Yes, we measure blood gas levels. We measure everything that can be measured scientifically in a hospital. And rightly so, that is the place. And yet, what gets missed, especially now, are the things that cannot be measured, the intangibles that contribute so significantly to a person's healing, to a person's recovery. And that is the support from loved ones, from family, who cannot come in. And so chaplaincy takes on a different meaning, a different, I won't say purpose, but a different kind of responsibility. And it's a weight that is difficult, but yet welcomed. And I love it there.
And it strikes me that you haven't specifically done chaplaincy work for years and years and years, and suddenly we hit a pandemic, but you started in doing it, and then fairly soon?
Yes. Within 6 weeks after I started, COVID-19 became a household name. And, you know, what we saw early on, I started in January of 2020, and there were lots and lots of deaths during January and February. And in hindsight, and only in hindsight, people have come to realize that we had COVID here way before we even knew what it was. And that's why the mortality rate was so high during those months, we assume. Now we know why. Now we know what's going on. But yes, right from the get-go, as a brand new chaplain immersed in the world of a global pandemic.
But my sense is that you would still say being a chaplain is really rewarding and important work.
Absolutely, without a question. You know, some of the most difficult work is in the intensive care unit. And I can't talk about specific or unable to talk about specific cases, but one of the most wrenching days for me was a day when there were back-to-back terminal extubations of patients who had COVID. And a terminal extubation is when they're on a ventilator helping them breathe and basically can do no more. And the decision is made to remove the life support. And so I just got done being present for one terminal extubation and trying to collect myself and reflect. And the one across the hall, they called me over there for the next one. And mind you, this is without family present. Family so much wants to be there. And yet we are the ones, the chaplains, the nurses, the doctors, who accompany one to their last breath so that they don't die alone. Those are sad stories, but there's also very happy stories. One of my best memories is another COVID patient, and I can talk about this one because it made national news, of a woman who had COVID, gave birth to her first baby while in a coma with COVID. And I had the delight to go up to the family birth center where the baby was and take the baby's feet prints, you know, that certificate that hospitals give, down to the mother and give them to the mother. And this was the first time that she had ever seen anything of her baby were these footprints. So there are little things like that that are remarkable and also joyously endeared to my heart. That's also a joy of being a chaplain.
We're out of time, but I just have to say, I loved your phrase of beautifully difficult. I love that idea. And also on behalf of the people of Portland Mennonite, I want to thank you for this really, really important work that you're doing and sharing some of what it's like with us. These are just priceless stories, and I'm just so grateful for your being willing to share with us.
Thank you, Gloria, for the opportunity.
And thank you for joining us for this episode of COVID Chronicles. We hope you discovered something new and feel more connected to your friends at Portland Mennonite. I'm your host, Gloria Nussbaum. Until next time, stay well and keep the faith.